Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
There's a moment when you're with the Pink Floyd, I think in about 1987. I think you're in their private aircraft. Is it 727?
It was a 727.
Right. How many people are on board?
It had a capacity for 22. I think there were about 18 of us. And, yeah, it used to be... It was built for some... Or converted for some Arab prince.
Of course.
Of course. And it just had this ridiculous... It had a bedroom with a sort of black satin bed and everything. A marble... bathroom, again. Which was the last thing you want to put
on a plane. Bathroom.
It's not a plane. Bathroom. It's brilliant. So the back end sort of just down.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's a dining room and a lounge area. And so it had this big, wide lounge thing. And we all used to fly it. Everyone used to take turns flying the plane. I mean, what could be easier?
So the pilot would just say, OK, you know, drummer who's had 6 or 7 pints of Kronenbourg, step up.
Well, yeah, but...
Sit in the... You
that's
know.
Right. Well, it was David you had to worry about. Because it was Nick. Nick actually always tended to sort of have the most wise bedtimes, I think.
Oh, this is Nick Mason,
yeah,
the
Nick
drummer.
Mason, then, who's actually very accomplished pilot. He flies helicopters and stuff as well.
But when yeah, Nick... Didn't you do some terrible things?
We had this thing of... whenever Nick was flying the plane, we'd all get together in a sort of scrum... in the middle of the lounge and run up and down, which of course then made the plane very unstable. So Nick would be up the front.
So he's got no idea.
He's got no idea. He's up the front of the game. I thought you could fly. Sorry, no, I didn't think I could. And I mean, yeah, because here's the
brilliant idea, but everything's fine. You know, David Gilmour at the wheel and you're at the wheel. And then Nick Mason turns and suddenly it appears to be sort of imaginary turbulence.
Exactly.
And he's flying around.
But it was, I mean, bear in mind, because on this thing, because it used to be, you know, on any plane, I mean, if you're in economy or in first class, whatever, you still have to put your seat back upright and do your seatbelt and tray table when you take off. Whereas we used to have competitions to see who could stay standing up the longest.
It's so mature, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's the most expensive.
Listeners, let me welcome you to the base cast. We have as our guest this week the great Guy Pratt, who's interviewed by James May on my right, and we have Fraser at the Wheels of Steel over here. James has written this absolutely sensational article, which I'm sure you've probably already read, actually, in the current edition of The Word. And I'm sure they have. They read all Med's great work.
It's unputdownable.
And it's unputdownable. And Guy is here to try and help shed some light on the mysterious world, the put-upon world, the often ignored, shadowy figures behind the drum riser. And now you
next
were
the drum, let me just not go behind the drum.
No, no, next time. Next, that would be very, very far down the scale. Yeah, that would be appalling. But no, so at the age of 25, you're in Pink Floyd. Now, I need to know how somebody gets to be at the, well, in fact, replacing Roger Waters, of course, at the time. We'll get to that in a moment. But how did you start? You were in a group, I think, called the, was it the Lillettes?
The Lillettes.
Brilliant. Was it a mod band?
No, it was a punk band.
Brilliant name.
And that was. I don't know. I don't know. That was just people I knew in London, and then my first proper band was the old advert in the back of Melody Maker, which is, you know, mod band seeks bassist, and so which I fancied because I was kind of I was a bit of a punk rocker, but I was too sort of scared really. So I liked the idea of being a mod because it seemed like it had all the elements of punk.
So this is what this is mod revival.
Yeah, it was that whole revival. Yeah, 79. Exactly. Purple Hearts, Merton Parkers. Supported all of them.
I probably saw you. When I was at NME, this was my job. I was on the mod revival beat. Yeah, Chords particularly, I remember.
The Chords were great.
They were great.
Maybe Tomorrow, I think, was a great,
yes,
great sort of lost power pop single.
They were.
They're still going, by the way.
Are they really?
Yeah.
They're probably.
There's this whole little mod scene that's still
there.
They caught me doing Maybe Yesterday.
terrifying.
And then I don't know. I just sort of. This was back in the days when you squatted up Ladbroke Grove, when Notting Hill was just, you know, cheap and very cool. And I ended up being asked to join this Australian band called Ice House because that was the whole thing.
Because
when we all discovered sort of funk and hip hop, of course, no one else in the world did. It was just us. And there was this Australian band. Of course, no one was into anything like that over there, so they thought it would be very cool and pretentious to have an English bass player. So I got flown over to Australia.
What a lovely idea that you pick an English person for pretentious reasons.
Is that the same reason Blondie had an English bass player, do you think?
Do you know what? I only found out he was English in that last Blondie documentary. I'd never known that. He'd been around for... Yeah, well, also, because he had fantastic punk credentials, didn't he? I mean, Nigel, he used to play for Iggy back in, like, 73.
No.
Yeah. You see pictures of Iggy playing at Rodney's English Discotheque, and there he is. Yeah, and
so you're out there being pretentious with
Icehouse. Being pretentious. Yeah. Why had an Anthony Price suit, you know? And from that we had this one hit in England, you know, "Hey Little Girl," which everyone bought because they thought it was Roxy Music. And then you go out and you do festivals and stuff. And then I got spotted by Robert Palmer, and he said you should come play with me. And then from that I met this producer, and then he should play on this. And then he's, you know, and one thing leads to the other. And then I sort of ended up with Brian Ferry, and then. David Gilmour wasn't very busy at the time, so he was coming down to play guitar on that quite a lot. And then, basically, Tony Levin said no to Pink Floyd, because the tour was too long, and so David asked me.
What a fantasy. That was a 13-month job, is that right?
Around 13 months, yeah. It was like a school year.
So you go from effectively being pretentious with the Ice House to suddenly on the old 70s. That's absolutely astonishing. Mm. And what was that? I mean, what was that like, just to go...
It was amazing. It was everything...
It was the biggest group in the world at the time, wasn't it?
It was that tour. I remember we were on News at 10.
The Delicate Sound of Thunder tour.
That's right,
yeah.
And it was... Yeah, it was... And it was just... Also, they'd never toured for more than 2 months before. They never went out and did those sort of campaign-type tours. And it was also very much a thing of... David had to go out and become a rock star for the first time in his life.
Of course, he was the new frontman,
wasn't he? He had to suddenly establish himself, because suddenly there was Roger out doing his thing. And we were this sort of gang of musketeers all there, all behind David, supporting him as much as we could. And which I think is why, musically, it's not great. Because that sort of music requires a bit of darkness and a bit of tension and, you know...
I want to ask you about, so you're being brought into what is a very kind of intimate relationship, really, isn't it? Which is that Roger Waters and Nick Mason have played together as the rhythm section for God knows how many years, and suddenly Waters is gone, you're replacing him. And if you think, you know, you think of, I don't know, Manny and Rennie, you know, on Tears by the Stone Roses, you know, they're brothers in rhythm, all actual brothers like Astor and Carly Barrett, Wailers. Or you think about Tina Weymouth
and Sly, and
Weymouth and Chris Frantz. So we were actually a couple, and you think how intensely close
friends for life you've got to be, haven't you?
Friends for life, I think
unless
so.
You're you.
Yeah,
and then you come in, and in fact, now James, what does he tell you here in the piece? This is Nick Mason.
He told me that basically he said it's better to play with Roger because he's not as good, but he said that as if I play with Roger, we sort of play along in a particular way. If I play with Guy, I know he'll play it perfectly, and consequently, I'll know when I've made the mistake.
Right, now...
Now, is that a fair... You're right to reply to Nick Mason.
I don't right reply to this.
Yeah.
Dear Mr. Mason...
my learned friends...
It's like, Nick is a very dear friend. This is absolutely fine. But was that interview for this article?
No,
or was
I
that
have
a quote
confess.
That happened to be in 2007 when I put it to you that Nick Mason was on tour with Roger Waters playing Dark Side of the Moon and I had to come up with something nice to say about playing with Roger?
I think we're bang to rights, though.
Guilty as charged.
Get out of
you
that
are so right, you know.
Of course
I have
right.
to confess that was...
I'm sorry, Nick's being a little disingenuous.
No, it's not. It's from him, I think you're absolutely right.
Of course it was,
because
he just wouldn't have said it otherwise. And it's the idea that Nick doesn't like having someone standing next to him who's going to nail it every night. And when he uses the word sloppy, it's like people use many adjectives to describe Pink Floyd shows. Sloppy is not one of them.
Okay, yeah. But how did you fill in for Roger Waters, who, to put it politely, is not the most adventurous of bassists?
He's not really a bass player, and that doesn't really matter. I mean, I feel quite safe saying that, because the thing is, Roger's a writer and conceptualist, and if he'd never played bass on anything, it wouldn't really affect his input to bass. You know, he wrote a lot of those great bass lines, like Money and stuff, but, David played an awful lot of the bass on those records.
Did he?
Just because he's such a consummate musician.
Which ones?
The Wall features quite a lot of fretless bass.
And that's David Gilmour.
Yeah, right. He's an amazing fretless player. I think David often played the bass just for expediency, you know. Like Roger plays a bit of bass on his shows now, but not that much. But Roger's not a bass player. I mean, he can play the bass, and he's great, and he does the job, but he's a writer. He doesn't, you know, it's not important. I think he's just the guy who happens to have the bass. So, and I certainly, growing up as a bass player, sort of Nick and Roger were one of the great rhythm section partnerships that I you know, aspired to. I love playing with Nick. That's the other thing. I mean, with Nick, we used to have another guy playing percussion or drums, and I always deferred to Nick, always, because he had that lovely lazy pocket. Which
yeah,
is what
I think
defines
he's
that Pink
really
Floyd
nice
sound.
Drummer.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Lovely to play with. So, but there it is. And I, you know.
There's a great quote in the article about, I can't remember where it's from. Then. Is it Sir Horace Gentleman of the Specials? I think it is, where he says, if the drummer, yeah, really good.
Really great.
And not only a great bass player,
he
played those lines in midair, hopping.
He'd be hopping.
While playing them. I don't know how anyone could play them actually sitting down in controlled circumstances. An amazing guy. And I think he says that if the drummer and the guitar player make a mistake, it's jazz. But if the bass player makes a mistake, the wheels fall off, don't they? Yeah. The whole thing falls apart. And that's,
I see it completely the other way around.
Oh, right, go on.
I mean, I said the one guy who can't make a mistake is the drummer. If you're a drummer, you cannot make a mistake. You have absolutely no... You're right, if the guitarist can make it jazz... I mean, it depends who you're playing with. If you're in a three-piece, most of the bands I've been touring with the last few years, Roxy Music or Brian Ferry, there's 11 people on stage. I've got to cock up really badly before anyone even notices I'm there. Sometimes it's worth doing.
Dream
it.
Job. Dream job.
You see, it could be me.
So you can go on stage. It could be me, exactly. Yeah, you can go on, you can have three or four pints of Cronenberg. You'll be thinking about something else, you know, and no one's going to know. Brilliant. How perfect. But no,
the audience is going to know. The band, though.
The band will know, that's very true, the band will know. I think we should ask you about, just a quick reaction, just a few sentences about various people you play with, because there's an extraordinary combination. There's Echo and the Bunny Men, I mean, Roxy Men. I mean, well, just give us some indications of what it's like to be with them. And the variety is incredible, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
The Smiths,
yeah.
I think, at one point.
I only rehearsed with them. I was sort of in the Smiths for a week, which just sounds great as a tagline, rather than...
But he came back, Andy Rourke came back, did he?
Andy Rourke came back. Well, it was also, or... there was a rather unfortunate incident at Stanbridge Rehearsal Studio down in Sussex, where, you know, we were young.
Or did it involve Mr. Morrissey?
Well, it's
hardly going to be your fault.
It did involve the fact that some of us stayed up really very late. Me and Johnny especially. We stayed up really very late.
This is
1987, actually.
Yeah.
Not happened that year. And we went to bed at about 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning. And I went up to bed and realised, because of whatever it was that we'd been up to, that I couldn't actually sleep. And I thought, well, Johnny must be feeling the same way too. So I went to what I thought was Johnny's room, started tapping on the door, going, Johnny, come on. I know there's some left. Come on, mate. And started banging my head. And then banging more and more, until eventually shouting, goes, oh, some mate you are, bastard, and screaming, stormed off to bed. And, of course, it was Morrissey's room.
And I can't imagine he'd seen the funny side.
No, of course he'd gone to bed straight after Dad's army and
with a biscuit.
Yeah. A nice cup of tea.
Nice cup of tea, that's right.
A slim volume of poetry.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and so he basically just got up, got the train to London and I was.
You didn't get the job. You did not get the job.
No.
Fantastic. No, I want to know more.
I must say, because playing with Johnny was always, and it's something I've gone on to do. I haven't done it for many years, but, you know, we're still in touch. He's just one of the most brilliant people ever. And he's still so excited by playing the guitar. That's something I kind of envy someone who's still like that.
Yeah,
and you can tell Johnny Marr gets up in the morning and he just wants to play the guitar all day.
It's like Keith Richards. You know, he doesn't want to lead a group, he just wants to be in one. So he's constantly in Modest Mouth or whatever. You know, there's some group he's supposed to attach himself to, and he's never
in Cribs.
Cribs. I know, yeah. Fantastic. So we want a few more of these. We want The Orb.
They're
Madonna.
Old schoolmates.
I mean, old school. Oh, are they?
I was at school with youth, Martin Glover and Alex Paterson. Yeah, we were all at school together. And so that's why we've always just been in touch.
But what was your involvement? Have you been toured with them?
No, I haven't toured with The Orb. It's a really funny thing, getting used to that whole world of sample dance music. I remember, I wrote a song on the first album, then I just turn up and do odd little bits on, you know, whenever they're about. I did a spin-off project with Alex Paterson and Jimmy Courty from the KLF. We did an album together, which was good fun. But though, I remember I was in LA, it was about 1991, when The Orb had sort of just happened. They were huge, and they came to LA and went to this gig, and they played the song that I was involved with, which has about three tracks of me playing bass and stuff. And it was great. Afterwards, Alex said, I knew you were coming, so I made you really loud tonight.
Fantastic.
How about inviting me up?
Yes.
Instead of making me loud in the audience.
It's a strange compliment.
It's a strange compliment, yeah. I knew you were here, so I made you really loud.
Yeah, yeah. And what about Madonna? I mean, how did that work?
Time is money and the money is mine!
Is that a direct quote?
There's a direct quote. There's absolutely a direct quote.
That's the kind of thing you get on a talk back when you're in the studio. Madonna's in the console.
Time, yeah. Yeah, we get that all the time. Was that a good take, Guy? I thought it was pretty good. Did I make your dick hard?
Is that what she said?
Yeah.
God, terrifying.
Should we go again?
See, that I would find that very intimidating.
Yeah. It was somewhat intimidating, but she was brilliant, and she was always absolutely right about everything. That's what was really terrifying, was that because we'd have the whole band in, and it was and I was terrified anyway, because it was always musicians whose names I knew from Steely Dan records, you know, proper grown-ups.
What kind of people?
You know, Dan Huff, Skunk Jeff Baccaro, and, you know... I think Larry Carlton was in once or twice. Bruce Gaich, you know, of course, Pat Leonard playing keyboards and producing.
Can you imagine how much this would cost per hour, all these people in one room? Jesus.
Well, it's going to recoup.
Also, no, what is she saying?
Yeah, but also, bear in mind that I've been put on a plane from London, stuck up the pointy end, flown, put in an apartment in Beverly Hills, given a car, given PDs and everything, then being paid whatever. So I was saying, you know, to play bass in a town with 35,000 amazing bass players.
Is this for one track?
That'd be for an album.
It'd be an album.
Which album was that?
I did Like a Prayer.
Fantastic.
And in fact, the title song of which is probably the proudest moment of my career. I actually did this insane bass stuff on the end, which is me doing a sort of punk Pino thing. In fact, when I heard it mixed, she invited me down to the mix. And I thought, God, that bass is amazing. But I couldn't believe it was me, because I couldn't believe I'd be allowed to do that. It sounded like me, but I thought, can't be me. And when I said to her, I said, that bass is amazing. Genuinely, I really meant it. That bass is amazing. Who is it? She went, you, dummy! That's
You have been listening to the free feed of the Word podcast. The full album-length version is only available to subscribers to the magazine. To sign up and to hear the rest of this podcast, go to www.wordpodcast.co.uk.